Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin's Eyes Look at this week in the Capitol. Wisai was there. We asked four of our fellow Capitol reporters to talk about the budget deal in Foxconn. There's a major effort. It's a bipartisan effort to expand sign language signing to those that are deaf, and fashion tips from the director of the Veterans Museum. Wisai was there.
$76 billion budget. I mean, this is very much a re-election document for the governor. It, you know, increases a very healthy amount for schools, holds property taxes down. So this is going to be the thing that Scott Walker is going to be talking about, you know, for the next more than a year as he tries to get a third term.
It took July 7 months to get the budget done, arguably, and 7 weeks to get Foxconn done.
And so much of the debate in the legislation was, you know, how many sort of accountability measures can you put into statute and how much do you have to leave to the contract? And the argument was continually, well, that's for the contract, but we don't know what's going to be in the contract until it's done.
The new law is going to get interpreters back to work and improves how we match an interpreter's knowledge and skill level in critical settings such as legal, mental health, medical settings.
Wherever you stand on abortion, I think the one thing we all agree on is that there should be less of it in the world. Everybody says that.
If you were to ask a university professor, they will, I guarantee you, 100% of them will say, but we do protect free speech. We do everything we can to protect free speech. I mean, we want dissent. We think it's wonderful. And then you go to the public, and the public is looking at what's going on at the campus, and they're going, this is unbelievable. We're shouting down speakers. We're preventing speakers. We're not funding organizations. We're not allowing certain students to write what they want to write.
The First Amendment only applies to the government. So, for example, Facebook, if Facebook decides they do or don't want certain ads, that's not generally viewed as a First Amendment problem.
Hey, my big deal is the beer tax hasn't been raised since 1969. And the Tavern League customers are using these roads. I think they should take that and put that towards towards transportation funding.
I understand that one thing drives you crazy, when people refer to your museum as a war museum. Why does that drive you crazy?
Well, because that's a one-dimensional definition. We really are trying to move in the direction of telling the personal stories of the veterans. And that's why we say every veteran is a story. Whether the veteran is seeing combat action or not, there's a story there.
What is it?
What
though?
Is the secret to dressing well?
Never, never buy cheap shoes.
Yeah, the shoes are so important.
Well, Russian efforts, pre-election, important national news, and our state officials did a little bit on the subject that just frankly confused the heck out of me. Mm-hmm. Because if I've got the timeline right, in summer, Homeland Security says you may want to check out these IP addresses. Our chief technology officer says we block. But then last week, Friday, notified hackers may have sought Wisconsin election voter data. Then the election commission's meets. And there's another email. Do you think we were hacked?
It sounds like they were probing our system.
Shaking the doorknobs?
Yeah.
As the technology officer
our reporter was at that news conference, and they're asking about this announcement from Friday about the attempt, and they walk up with this email and say, oh, but wait, here's this.
Yeah.
They're targeting DWD. And so that seemed to say, well, that was an attempted hack.
They're shaking the DWD doorknob instead of the election.
They're probing to see where they could find a vulnerability. The bottom line seems to be that DHS is now saying we stand by our initial assessment. They're trying to get into the elections front door.
Right.
But the message from them was confusing about what was really happening. They didn't really explain themselves very well. They caused a little bit of confusion about what's going on. And it's kind of not entertaining is the right word, but at least somewhat like situation normal with state government
right.
sometimes.
And let's just listen to, we asked Scott Bauer at the Capitol Roundtable to talk about the timeline, and then let's go into the rare apology issued by the chairman of the State Elections Commission for not asking or not going deep enough. So let's listen to some of that audio. Scott, you were the only one that covered the Elections Commission yesterday. I followed it on Wisconsin Eye, and my head exploded. Walk me through that. At one point,
on Thursday, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said, we're going to notify the states whether you were one of the 21 or not. They've said before they were 21. They've never said which ones they were. Wisconsin apparently had asked if they were one of the 21, and they were never told that they were. So on Friday, the phone rings, and Homeland Security tells Wisconsin, you were one of the 21. Surprise. Tuesday, there was a previously scheduled meeting of the Elections Commission. They hold the meeting, bring in the tech experts to talk about what happened here. Tech guys say they never went after elections. They were hitting on workforce development. Homeland Security puts out another statement and says, we stand by the 21 states, and you can't just make assumptions based on the IP addresses. Wisconsin was a target. They may have missed the target, but it was still a target.
I want to issue a personal apology as the chair. This commission previously reported that there had been no attempts to hack the Wisconsin system. Friday, I was told that that wasn't the case. Apparently, as the chair and I set the agenda, I didn't ask enough questions because if we would have asked more questions, we would have or should have known about what we're going to hear later today. And for that, I apologize.
One scary number from the state's chief technology officer, what he calls port scans, where unknown actors try to shake the doorknobs 9 million times in 2016 for just our state government. But my question, JR, there seems to be now an emphasis going forward that let's find some way to lock out any hackers, Russian or whoever, for the 2018 elections, which are major elections. So that's kind of where the focus shifts,
yeah.
Don't you think?
So the question is, we haven't seen any evidence so far, by the way, of any tampering with the actual results. So that seems to be slowly firm. But, yeah, there's going to be extra awareness ahead of next fall with what's going on right now.
Okay. So going back to the question, do we know what really happened?
I'm not sure.
I understand. So let's move on. Last week, the governor chose a former GOP lawmaker from Eagle River, Dan Meyer, to be the next secretary of the State Department of Natural Resources. I was surprised. What did you heard?
This seems like a appointment that's a nod to the hook and bullet crowd, that these hunters and anglers in Wisconsin weren't necessarily that happy with Kathy Stepp. She came from more of a business background as a developer. If you go back to 2010, when Governor Walker first won office, he said he wanted somebody with a Chamber of Commerce mentality at DNR to kind of work more with the business community. Stepp fit that role. But in focusing on those things, there was a feeling among these hunters and anglers that she wasn't paying attention to their issues and that they suffered during her 6 years. Meyer has a background of being on the Natural Resources Committee when he was in the legislature, the Joint Finance Committee,
yes,
with some emphasis on natural resources issues. He's from northern Wisconsin, which is really kind of like one of our hotbeds of hunting and fishing. He fits that profile, somebody who knows that crowd and will be able to communicate with them effectively to address their concerns.
Okay. Yeah. He was really quiet on joint finance, but yes, on some issues when he spoke, and, people took notice.
There are critics. I mean, the environmental community is not going to be happy with anybody Governor Walker picks because it's Governor Walker, let's be honest. You know, they don't think very highly of his term so far. So Meyer has his critics, but even some folks in that like former Secretary George Meyer said, you know, he's got these things I didn't like about, but also issued some praise about him and how he came around on a few issues as he was in the legislature. So, but he really fits that profile of the guy who can go talk to a hunter in northern Wisconsin and say, okay, what's the issue? What can we do for you?
Former mayor of Eagle River and, as you said, former Chamber of Commerce. Mm-hmm. Then he served in the ledge for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And the governor said, Dan Meyer understands the balance between protecting our natural resources and supporting economic prosperity in our state. But while we're on the subject of the governor, you found out that he got a very interesting three emails.
Text messages from
Assembly Speaker Voss. I'll just say one. I won't forget this. No, I'll say two. Very disappointed in the way I've been treated. Three, we aren't changing our deal to get Senate votes. Provide the context on that, please.
So the final days of the budget being considered in the state Senate, Robin Voss has said the Assembly will not come back and take it up. They passed it. They were done. Three Republican senators said, we don't like this budget. We need changes to vote for it. Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader in the Senate, has a 2013 majority. He was down one because Dave Craig was considered a no right off the bat. So he needed at least two of those three guys, these other three senators, Chris Capiglia, Steve Noss, and Dewey Strobel, to vote for it. They said, we have to have this last-minute drama. In the end, the governor promised a series of vetoes of these guys to get their support. So while he's doing this, he's in South Korea, by the way, on a trade mission. So the open records request that I got back from the governor's office, it lists these three text messages as being received on September 16th, which is the day after the Senate voted. Yeah. We don't know for sure I don't know what kind of plan the governor is on, if he received these, like if Robin sent them different days and they all show up at one time or what. But it was clear Robin Voss sending a message to Governor Walker about these deals saying, don't do this. And once you, now that you've done it, we've got a problem.
There are a lot of emotions, as you and I know, in end of the session deals that result in a budget. Now, they're taking 3 or 4 weeks off before they come back. How seriously damages the relationship? Is the relationship between the speaker and the governor damaged?
Well, it's been strained for a while. This is not the first time their text messages have popped up.
That's a good term.
Go back to April. There's another story about them both going in. Now, Governor Walker didn't actually respond to Robin Voss from the records that I got. Either A, he learned a lesson from this past spring, those messages came out, or B, he was, overseas and said, well, it's not worth it. Either way, we've seen this percolate before. And oh, by the way, go back to 2015. There were tensions in that budget. They just did a better job keeping it under wraps. I mean, if you talk to people off the record, they would complain about Governor Walker a lot because he left the state to go run for president. He basically introduced a budget, said, okay, here you go, get this done quickly. And that was his message. He introduced it early in 2015 to get this done quickly. I remember being in Joint Finance, the hearing room on a Friday night, Memorial Day weekend. Governor Walker was in New Hampshire, I believe, on a riverboat raising money for his presidential campaign. Republicans went, we're not fixing transportation in this budget, but they papered it all over. They got a budget done, and they all kind of had put smiles on. This time, from day one of this budget, there were tensions popping up. They just had it more out in the open this time versus 2 years ago, and the tensions have heightened between the East Wing and lawmakers.
When the Speaker of the Assembly tells the governor, I won't forget, does that mean at some point one of the governor's priorities is going to have a bit of a problem in Mr. Voss's assembly?
As long as he has support of his members, yes. Now, I've talked to people who said there are a lot of lawmakers unhappy with Governor Walker right now, not just Robin Voss, that there are people who are disappointed now. Again, it's, things afloat in the Capitol. But
it's the post-budget.
Yeah, they need some time away from
finger pointing,
each other.
Yep.
The question becomes, when push comes to shove, is a piece of legislation that Governor Walker wants or needs, what will Robin Voss do? Good question. Oh, by the way, Governor Walker got what he needed out of this session to run for re-election next year, which was the budget that has no property tax, a smaller property tax bill in 2018 for this mythical median-valued home than 2014, no gas tax increase, and a massive investment in education. He got his platform to run for re-election. I'm not sure that he needs, a mining bill, that he needs a fetal tissue bill, or he needs these other priorities out there, Marcy's Law. I don't think he needs them to run for election. Those things he needed for the platform for this announcement we're going to see, I think, in November.
In November, about a year from the reelect, about a year from the election. Also, speaking of the election for governor, Democratic Senator Kathleen Vineout of Alma, elected in 06 and then
10 and 14. Yep.
10 and 14. Announced she's running for governor. She lives on a farm, organic farm, former Alma dairy farmer. She was a college professor in Illinois, elected to the Senate, as you said, in 2006. Says she ran for the Senate because family had no health care, making health care a centerpiece of her campaign. I know you're going to mention her later in the show, but any surprises in her rollout?
We knew she was going to run for a long time. I mean, she's been gearing up for a while. Remember, she ran in 2012 in the recall election, the primary, finished a very distant third place in a five-person race. In 2013, she was traveling the state to try and lay the foundation for a bid for governor in 2014, got into a car wreck, damaged her arm badly, had dropped out because she was recovering from that. And has been saying pretty much since after 2014, I'm going to look at it. So This is no surprise. She's been billing for this for a while.
Okay, and the GOP statement, the statement from the Republican Party of Wisconsin, Vinehout's disastrous tax and spend agenda will take Wisconsin backwards. Yesterday, Kathleen Vinehout sat where you are sitting and gave us a compendium of some of the major issues. Let's listen to just a summary of a few of a little bit of that interview, all of which is at wisi.org.
We have had Medicaid since 1965. And frankly, you know, anybody who looks at the budget knows, a third, almost a third of the entire all funds budget is healthcare. One in five people in this state take advantage of somehow some part of Medicaid. We could not function as a state, nor could any other state function as a state if Medicaid went away. I have for quite a long time been watching the increased dollars go to private corporations who administer the Medicaid program. If the state brought some of that administration in-house, we could save 30%. We have a big problem, the transportation fund. We can pay for what we're buying. The state can borrow and pay for it later, or we cannot do it, and what happens? We pay for it, you and me, when we hit that pothole and need another front end.
The gas tax hasn't been raised since 2006. Should it go up?
Yes.
How many pennies?
Well, it should go up. My proposal is to send it up 5 pennies. This raises about $350 million. It gets us about the third of the way that we need to. Let's take the school levy tax credit, put it into equalized aid, hold every school harmless, so no school gets less money under the new formula, bring up a foundation of about $3,000 per student, so every school gets a basic foundation from, you know, Washington Island to Walworth to
Mequon,
right. Everybody gets a basic foundation, and then put the equalized aid formula on top of that and change it so that it recognizes some of the problems that schools see in the way they do their budget. For example, it costs more to educate a child in poverty.
Let's spend a little time on a study that was released, done by two UW political science professors, but let's stay at the outside. Mm-hmm. It was paid for by the Dane County clerk, who's a Democrat.
I also oppose a voter ID.
Okay, so let's say that it's paid for by a Democrat, mm-hmm. but now let's get into some of the findings. The two professors sent 2,400 surveys just to voters in our two largest counties, Milwaukee and Dane. They got a response of 293, and I don't know stats, so that's not very high, it seems to me. Okay, let's just talk about the two conclusions. First of all, the issue was, did the photo ID law deter you from voting? And let's mention result number one. 8.3% of whites said yes, the photo ID law deterred me. 27% of blacks who responded. And then the second conclusion I want to dwell on, 21% of non-voting registrants with incomes of less than $25,000, that's important, said they were deterred. Only 7% of those with incomes of greater than $25,000 were deterred. Now, I asked the Republican Party to comment on this study. I didn't hear back, but you got a response to it from
the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is a conservative outfit.
In Milwaukee, yes.
Basically really raised questions about the methodology that was used. First, it's called a self-selected respondent. So you sent out these surveys, but the people who responded to you, they had to mail something back. That raises a question for some people about methodology. The number of people actually said that they did not vote because voter ID was fairly small in those respondents. Now, the key thing is deterred does not mean prevented. A lot of people who had voter ID, valid IDs.
Thank you for saying that.
Said
that
they were deterred.
Yes.
Because they thought it wasn't valid or they were whatnot. So prevented is a different story. Got a lot of national media attention.
It really did. It surprised me.
But will really raise questions about the validity of the methodology, because you think about it, this was mailed to people who did not vote, who registered but did not vote. 293 people out of that many thousands of people is not, if I were getting a survey from any other outfit who did a phone survey, that would be a very low number with a very high margin for error. Okay. So there are questions about that. I think, though, the point these authors are trying to make is that there is still a misperception out there. You people who have valid ID are still confused about what's going on. Now, depending on where you fell on this issue, if you believe voter ID is good or believe it's bad, you seized on pieces of it to try either raise questions about the study or say, look, this is very damaging. I think what's being lost a little bit is the idea of there is still a lack of public awareness, for some people at least, about what voter ID means, what is a valid ID, and what you need to do to get one to go to the polls.
Yeah, okay. Because of the limitations and the narrowness of the scope, time to move on.
Yeah.
We had a discussion for 2 or 3 years as a state how to test our students. The results of the latest set of tests were given, these were tests given to 453,000 students in public and choice schools, grades 3 through 8 and grade 11. And DPI released the results, and it showed 42% of students, only 42% of students were proficient in English and science, 40% were proficient in math. And then it also included much lower numbers for choice students, which I found very interesting, given the major choice debate, and we've expanded it. Now, when the Journal Sentinel quoted Jim Bender, who is a spokesman for the choice schools, as saying the results for choice students reflected the poor showings of Milwaukee and Racine choice students. JR, I bring this up because I think when the superintendent of public instruction is running against the governor, I think data like this has the potential to be a major issue in the gubernatorial campaign. Do you agree?
Absolutely, because Tony Evers is, now we've talked before, Evers has to make his campaign about more than just education. He has to talk about Medicaid and taxes and all these other things, but the foundation is education. If you can chip away the foundation of his campaign, you cause him issues with voters where they go, well, if you can't run that, how can we trust you to run these things? So yeah, very much going to be an issue next year in the election.
Right, but he said, his press release said, actually, we held steady, we may have made some minor gains, but still, go back to what the DPI's own report numbers said, 42% of students in grades 3 through 8 and grade 11 proficient in English and science, 40% in math. So we're just saying it's out there as a campaign issue.
I don't even get into the racial gap that we have in test scores that has been persistent. I've been here for 17 and a half years. You've been here much longer than that. Every time we get these test scores, they talk about the racial gap. It is significant, and the worst ones in the country. That'll also be an issue next year.
Right. Okay, I also had a chance to interview 4 representatives of the Heal Without Harm Coalition, made up of the Wisconsin Right to Life, the Catholic Conference, Wisconsin Family Action, Pro-Life Wisconsin. Here's why I did it, JR. They're going to make a major push for 2 bills. The first bill would make parents who suffer stillborns or miscarriages aware of the option of having research done on the child that they lost. Now, Wisconsin would be the first in the nation with that bill. The second one is, remember the controversy in the assembly, banning research on tissue from induced abortions. Mm-hmm. They have made a concession, dropping all criminal penalties. So the reason I did the show is they told me Senate Republicans are caucusing on this issue here pretty quick. It's a major issue for the fall. What are your thoughts before I hear from some of those
panels?
This
issue has percolated for a while. There is a significant divide between the wings of the Republican Party where they want to prevent the sale of tissue from abortions. That is universal. How to do that and what limits you can place is the problem, because the folks behind their approach want an approach that others say is unconstitutional. That if you pass that bill, great, it's going to go to the courts, they're going to strike it down, it's not going to work. These folks say this other option they're working on doesn't go far enough. It doesn't do anything significant. And they realize when you get a bill like this, they call it, you get one kick at the cat, right? You get one shot. If you don't do it, if you don't get your way on this bill, you may never visit this issue ever again. And so there is no middle ground that I've seen in 2, 3, 4 years of talking about this issue that's going to resolve this. Now, maybe they find some great compromise this session, but it has been difficult, and I've talked to lots of people who say they just don't know how it gets done.
2 years ago, they didn't even get a vote in committee in the assembly. So this year, they've targeted the Senate. They said Senator Moulton is leading both these bills. But let's listen to some of the panelists of who talked about the new effort to pass these 2 major bills. So this is a segment. These are clips from the Newsmakers show that Wisconsin I did this week.
We don't oppose research at all. What we want is research done using ethical material, done in an ethical way. And so we've come together with a single purpose to promote ethical research in our state. And right now, the bill before us is one that deals with how do we handle the remains of aborted babies? And how do we find ethical sources for fetal tissue research to go on in the state?
There's one bill that really promotes ethical means of research. So obtaining fetal tissue from individuals who've experienced a stillbirth or miscarriage. Mm-hmm. Stillborn and miscarriages from anywhere from 20 weeks on or 18 weeks on compared to abortions for that same period almost mimic each other in terms of numbers. But there aren't a lot of donations being made from stillborn or miscarried unborn children. And we thought, well, is there some way we can promote that? So the first bill just talks about incorporating that into our already existing Anatomical Gift Act in Wisconsin and making certain that parents are aware that this opportunity to provide a gift of their child and still provide proper disposition is possible. We don't have any criminal penalties for researchers at all in our bill.
That was a big issue.
That is. And there's no criminal penalties, period. Because we figured, well, if you're not penalizing individuals, and which would be the individuals? We don't want the parents, you don't want the researchers. Really, it relies on the facilities and the institutions, right, to carry the standard forward. So we went with civil forfeiture on the facilities mm-hmm. themselves, the research facilities, because they're really the ones responsible.
Let's take a look at what's ahead next week. I think the biggest story is the argument in the U.S. Supreme Court chambers in Washington, mm-hmm. hearing whether the redistricting plan Republicans passed in 2011 is constitutional. Now, this has major impact, and I just want to read arguments on both sides, just three sentences. The lawyers who want our redistricting maps overturned and the state ordered to draw new ones. Modern-day gerrymandering by both parties represents a grave and growing threat to the Constitution's vision of democracy. The court has not hesitated to step in when incumbents seek to entrench themselves at voters' expense or otherwise disenfranchise those they do not like. On the other side is our Attorney General, Brad Schimmel, who, along with his Solicitor General, said, federal courts lack jurisdiction to decide political questions. This court has never found that a state legislature engaged in unlawful partisan gerrymandering. Why is this so important, J.R.?
Because U.S. Supreme Court in the past has indicated, some justices have indicated, there may be a line that is going too far with the partisan gerrymander, but they don't know what that line is. This could be the first time that this U.S. Supreme Court establishes here is a standard going forward that by which all maps will be judged. Now, I mean, there's always the chance a court would issue some narrow ruling, but if you look at the sheer volume of people who weighed in on this case, the stakes are high. I mean, you seriously could have to open the door to where every map in the United States is challenged by somebody and say, well, that district has made this standard. It's called the efficiency gap, where you look at, okay, how many districts do you have where you have wasted votes, either where you have so diluted a party that they can never win this seat, or you have so concentrated the party that their votes are wasted because they win by huge margins. The Republicans are, you look, it's a geography thing. You know, Milwaukee is heavily Democratic. Madison is heavily Democratic. That's why I have so many Democrats in these districts. Democrats say, no, you've gone out of your way to try and pack these people together. So we'll see. I mean, if it does happen, it could be the best hope for Democrats in the Assembly that I've seen in recent years, because it could change the map and make it more efficient,
right,
or for them, you know, better for them.
Yeah.
If nothing happens, then they're stuck in this map that's not good for them until 2020 elections. Then they redraw them in 2021, and guess what? The maps were drawn to lock in Republican majorities for years.
So important here, and just very quickly, because we're almost out of time. We don't know when the Supreme Court is going to rule.
No.
If they don't rule until June, it would be very hard-pressed to draw new boundary lines.
It could be fun. It could be a fun summer in Madison.
Yes, it could. Okay, let's go to your stock report. Rising.
Michael Schrank, so the question's been, since he got in the race, is, will another conservative try?
Sauk County judge, right?
Yep. So he not that well-known in Milwaukee-Madison circles, legal circles. This week got endorsed by three sitting Supreme Court justices, Michael Gabelman, who's trying to replace, Rebecca Bradley, and Daniel Kelly, two former Supreme Court justices, and Wilcox and Prosser, but more importantly, two appeals court judges, Mark Gundrum and Brian Hagedorn. Why it's insignificant is Gundrum and Hagedorn have been floated as possible candidates either to run for the seat or to be appointed by Governor Walker if Gabelman leaves early. And we've talked before, Gabelman's being vetted for a job in the Trump administration, so we think he wants to leave, and then that would open the door. This basically signifies to the legal community, he's the guy with the inside track for all this stuff. He's going to get behind. And oh, by the way, if you're a conservative thinking about running for Supreme Court, you're not getting any support. This is going to be the guy we're getting behind.
Sends a big signal. Mm-hmm. Okay, mixed.
So Randy Bryce.
Democrat against Paul Ryan.
He's been announcing this week he's closing in on $1 million raise in this quarter alone. Now, as a challenger, first-time House candidate challenger, $1 million in a quarter and off year is like, that's crazy money. It looks like he's become a vessel for people around the country to who don't like Paul Ryan to vent their frustration, to send their hopes and dreams that he can take them out. The question, though, for Bryce is, what kind of candidate is he going to be? He's had some interviews that were kind of rough. He's not really kind of polished his speech on the Trump stump. And, oh, by the way, this week he declined to participate in a forum in Kenosha with another Democrat running for the seat. It sends a message of, you know, okay, you're criticizing Paul Ryan for not doing these forums, but you won't do one with your own primary opponent. The flip side is for him, there's no upside to do it because he's going to have a ton of money, a ton of infrastructure behind him, and she's not. You know, barring a miracle, she's not going to raise $1 million this quarter. So why elevate her, you know, to your status when you've got this kind of a machine going? So he's got this machine churning, but there are questions about what's behind the machine, how much substance there is this candidacy he's going to have to deal with.
That's a good call. Falling.
Kathleen Vinehout, there are certain things when you're a politician you don't want to touch at all. Child pornography is a big one. Now, Kathleen Vinehout wrote a letter, a character letter, on behalf of a alleged counsel attorney who'd been charged with 10 felony counts.
On state Senate letterhead.
Possessing child pornography.
He pled guilty to three of them.
Five, I think. But anyway, it was written before he pled guilty, before he's convicted. But she wrote on state letterhead saying, praising this guy for what a great
character
attorney
reference.
He was, character reference. There is, like somebody told me today, there is no amount of money she could raise to paper over doing that. Because you put that in front of the average voter, and they're going to go, what were you thinking? Now, Vinehout has said, my mother taught me to hate the sin but love the sinner. You know, obviously a redemption thing there. There are certain things, though, the public has a hard time seeing redemption from. This is one of them. The fact that she did it blows people's minds. It has a chance to really undercut her bid because her opponents can use this now and say, well, what kind of judgment do you have? Now, Vinehout is getting in. She's going to compete for the, you know, the outsider mantle. These are the kinds of things that are difficult to overcome.
So, as she tries to convince people to take her seriously, she announces on a Monday, and this comes out within 48 hours later.
Yeah.
And that's why she's falling.
Yeah, that's a difficult one to overcome.
Okay. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for September 29.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.